Granada Television presents The Hound of the Baskervilles. Gloomy, mist-covered moorland in the late evening light. A huge, stately home nestles in trees, its large array of chimneys jutting into the murky grey sky. Silhouetted, twisted black branches of trees bordering open fields. Four huge paws pace mist-hugged ground. Now, night. A grey-haired man in his 60s stands in the grounds of the house, taking in the air. He's wearing a dinner suit and a white bow tie. He looks around, puffing thoughtfully on a large cigar. His distinguished features and impressive white whiskers picked out in the cold white of fleeting moonlight. He lights a match, and holding it between thumb and forefinger, holds it up to the face of a brass fob watch. It's just after 10:15. He looks anxiously round, but sees nothing. Terrified, he spins round and dashes towards a large iron gate. Pulling it open, he races into a stone-walled garden and round to some stone steps leading up to a balustraded terrace. Glancing fearfully behind him, he runs on, arms flailing as he pushes through the blanket of darkness. The Hound of the Baskervilles by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, developed for television by John Hawksworth, dramatised by Trevor Bowen, starring Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes and Edward Hardwick as Dr. Watson, with Christopher Tabori, Ronald Pickup, James Faulkner, Rosemary McHale and Neil Duncan. Morning in central London. Horse-drawn carriages trundle down the straw-strewn, bustling street, people thronging the pavements, the women in long Victorian dresses, the men in top hats. A group of barefooted street urchins loiter outside the entrance of 221B Baker Street. Inside.
Finished. Oh.
Dr. Watson sitting in a corner. Holmes at the breakfast table watches Watson's reflection in a silver coffee pot lid as his friend picks up a smart walking stick.
What do you make of it, Watson?
Huh? I believe you've got eyes in the back of your head, Holmes.
Well, I have a well-polished coffee pot in front of me. Mrs. Hudson said it was left last night while we were out. What do you make of it?
Ah. Well, his name at least we know. I think Dr. Mortimer is a successful, elderly medical man. Well esteemed, since those who know him gave him this mark of their appreciation. Yeah. I think he's a country practitioner, does a good deal of visiting on foot. Friends of CCH. Hmm. I should guess that to be the local hunt.
Oh, bravo, bravo, Watson. You know, I am bound to say you habitually underrate your abilities.
Hmm.
It may be that you are not yourself luminous, but you are a conductor of light. Some people without possessing genius have a remarkable power for stimulating it. I confess that, my dear fellow, I am very much in your debt.
Thank you.
Watson walks to the mantelpiece and lights a cigarette.
But I am afraid that most of your conclusions were erroneous.
Watson looks round.
H. Surely, hospital. CC suggests Charing Cross. I mean, if so, I would postulate a young man, under 30, amiable, absent-minded, unambitious. And the possessor of a dog. Can I see the stick?
What? Oh.
Thank you.
Holmes gets up and takes the stick to the window, getting out a magnifying glass.
Larger than a terrier.
He inspects the black shaft.
smaller than a mastiff.
Glancing out of the window, he notices a hackney carriage pulling up below. A man and a dog climb out.
I was right. A curly-haired spaniel. Oh.
Watson stares incredulous.
Dr. Mortimer?
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I wasn't sure whether I'd left it here at the shipping office. The SS Gibraltar UC docks today at Tilbury.
Ah.
You interest me very much, Mr. Holmes. I'd hardly expected so dolicocephalic a skull or such well-marked supraorbital development. Would you have any objection to my running my finger along your parietal fissure?
Please, Dr. Mortimer.
A cast of your skull, sir, until the original becomes available. It is not my intention to be fulsome, but I confess, I covet your skull.
Behave and sit down, Dr. Mortimer.
That's what?
Mortimer, in his late 20s, leads his dog to a sofa.
Good boy.
Well, I presume that it was not your phrenological passion which drew you to Baker Street.
Unfortunately, it was not, sir. Spot?
He puts on glasses.
I have here the statement of a certain legend which runs in the Baskerville family.
Baskerville?
Yeah, I'm an executor of Sir Charles Baskerville's will and found it amongst his papers. It concerns Hugo de Baskerville, who was lord of the manor at Grimpen on Dartmoor.
Dartmoor?
Some 200 years ago. The document is somewhat later.
Holmes takes the folded parchment.
Learn then from this story to be circumspect in the future. For those foul passions whereby our family have suffered may not be loosed again to our culpable ruin. 8th of November, 1742, what is it? Intriguing preamble.
I've read of Sir Charles Baskerville's death.
Watson offers cigarettes.
From a medical point of view, it was a poorly informed article.
No, thank you. He died of dyspnea and cardiac exhaustion.
Were the conditions linked or were they parallel?
Oh, they were linked, in my opinion. There was some facial distortion.
Caused by the cardiac pain, presumably.
Yes.
You sound doubtful.
It was not merely facial distortion.
Well, in the year 1692, Hugo de Baskerville abducted a young girl. But she escaped across the moor that night. Cursing! He unkenneled his pack of hounds and hunted her down like a wild animal. When his three drunken companions followed, they found the girl in a deep dip or goyal, dead from fear and fatigue. They were also confronted the cause of her death, a huge demonic hound. Even as they looked, the hound tore the throat out of Hugo de Baskerville. One companion died that very night of what he saw, and the other twain were broken men for the rest of their days.
This hound is supposed to have haunted the family since then, to the general misfortune of the line.
Well, this may appeal to your lurid taste in fiction, Watson.
He hands the large document to Watson.
It's a fairy tale, sir.
Well, of course, Mr. Holmes. But fairy tales would not survive without a kernel of truth, On the night Sir Charles died, I arrived at Baskerville Hall at first light.
Mortimer, driving a trap, follows a horseman down the driveway lined with flaming torches.
I shall tell you what I found. No more or less.
Wait, please, sir.
I had been concerned about him for some time. He had become obsessed with the legend of the hound.
He's by the summer house.
He believed he had heard the hound itself upon the moors. He even believed he had seen it.
Mortimer is escorted through a formal garden towards the summer house.
At the time, I took such morbid fancies to be part and parcel of Sir Charles's pathological condition.
And now?
I no longer believe that to be the case.
He's there, sir. We didn't like to move him, sir. Once we knew.
Yes. Yes, quite tiring, Warren.
Mortimer turns to a middle-aged woman who's been waiting.
A sad occasion, Mrs. Barrymore. An unhappy vigil for you.
He was our hope, Doctor. Hope of the country hereabouts. He brought the world to us. He was our hope.
Mortimer walks up the steps leading onto the terrace. The whiskered man, Sir Charles, lies face down on the steps of a stone summer house. Barrymore, a dark, thickly bearded man, comforts his wife and looks across at Mortimer, now crouched down on the grass outside the garden gate.
Before Sir Charles ran up the alley, he had evidently stood at the gate for at least 10 minutes.
How do you know that?
The ash had dropped twice from his cigar, and there were also 3 spent matches.
Impress me, Dr. Mortimer. Was there anything else?
Yes.
Footprints. A man or a woman's?
Mr. Holmes. They were the footprints of a gigantic hound. Several people have seen a creature upon the moor, a huge creature, ghastly, spectral. I've cross-examined 2 of them, hard-headed countrymen both, and their stories tally. I want you to advise me what I should do with Sir Henry Baskerville.
London docks.
Henry Baskerville has spent his life in America. He has come over on the SS Gibraltar.
Send them direct to Baskerville.
Very good.
Been a pleasure having you aboard, Sir Henry.
Sir Henry. I still haven't gotten used to that title.
Was there any other claimant upon Sir Charles's estate?
None. His youngest brother, Roger, died in Central America of yellow fever some 30 years ago.
Northumberland Hotel, Northumberland Avenue.
Sir Henry is the last of the Baskervilles.
Sir Henry climbs into a hansom cab, which drives away. Sitting in an enclosed carriage nearby, a thickly bearded man taps his stick onto the roof. The driver urges on the horses.
Why did you not consult me immediately?
There is a realm in which the most accomplished detective is helpless. There are certain things here which are impossible to reconcile to the settled order of nature.
Yes, well, if you believe this to be supernatural, you'll find more help from a priest.
Mortimer looks up at Holmes, disappointed. Thoughtfully, Holmes rubs his hands.
No. How can I assist?
The Northumberland Hotel.
And I'll have an answer, damn it!
A bellboy's with Holmes.
He's in a stir, sir. About his boot.
Holmes and Watson go into the room.
By thunder, if that fellow can't find my old black boot.
Surely it was a new brown boot.
No. Last night, they took one of the brown ones. Today, they've sneaked one of the black. I'm sorry, Mortimer. I'm sorry to trouble you with this nonsense, but this is a first-class hotel, damn it.
Oh. Hello.
Mr. Sherlock Holmes at your service. I think it is worth troubling about, as a matter of fact.
You do? Why?
Because it's inexplicable.
Good. That's good.
A perfunctory smile flickers across Holmes's face. That night, Watson arrives back in Baker Street, the drawing room thick with pipe smoke.
My God!
Have you got a cold, Watson?
Oh, it's this poisonous atmosphere.
This is a bit thick, I suppose.
Thick? It's intolerable.
Watson swipes the air with a handkerchief.
You've been at your club all day.
How do you know that?
Watson opens a window.
Where do you think I'd be?
Oh, here, clearly. Clearly?
Oh. I've been in Devonshire.
In spirit?
Quite so. I sent out for a map from Stanford's.
He removes a drape from an easel.
Now, see here.
He taps pins stuck into the map with the end of his pipe.
Baskerville Hall. Grimpen. Just a clutter of cottages. Tumbleland houses. Farmhouses. Laughter Hall, Meadowpit House. I mean, that is all. Well, this represents marshland. And these barrels, some prehistoric settlement or burial ground. A tin mine. Disused, is that? And all the rest is waste. As far as the great convict prison.
Holmes taps the bottom of the map. Watson nods.
It is a worthy setting if the devil did decide to dabble in the affairs of man.
Then you yourself are inclining towards a supernatural explanation.
You'd better send word to Dr. Mortimer that we breakfast with him tomorrow.
At breakfast in the Northumberland.
It arrived by post this morning.
Holmes takes the sheet of paper stuck with words from a newspaper. The last word is handwritten.
So you think out little puzzles, Mr. Holmes. This one wants more thinking than I'm able to give it.
Posted yesterday?
Yes.
Watson shows it to Mortimer.
Joke is like us, not.
Tell Mr. Henry, has anything interesting happened to you since you've been in London?
No, I don't think so.
Have you been followed? What?
I seem to have walked right into a dime novel. Why should anyone follow me?
That letter was delivered to the hotel. You are being followed, Sir Henry.
He reads the message.
If you value your life or your reason, keep away from the moor. Now, the issue I suggest is whether it constitutes a friendly or an unfriendly warning.
Now, that is surely impossible to determine.
Now, there are various features which may help us. The envelope, for example. If somewhat crumpled, is presentable. Its contents, mostly, are not. The letter has been torn, neatly enough, along a fold. And the leader article in the Times, the Lady Bourgeois print, is unmistakable, has been chosen from which to cut the message. But the message is awkwardly cut, with inappropriate short-bladed scissors. And the gluing of the print to the paper is smudged and misaligned. Merci.
Cigarette in hand, he takes the off-white piece of paper from Watson and holds it up to the light.
Only half a sheet of paper, and yet the watermark is clear. Huddleston, Quail. You will find that paper in 100 middle-grade hotels, but not, I think, here. A first-class hotel would have paper of a greater weight. The ink is institutional.
Mortimer examines the note.
That also suggests a hotel.
Yeah. What can we determine from this?
With his magnifying glass, Holmes examines the envelope seal.
Pocket flap. I infer that the person who wrote this message is staying at a nearby hotel. He's neat of habit and started the task methodically. But then he began to fear discovery. He rushed it through. And put the result into his pocket until such time as he posted it. It is true that fearful people threaten. But my interpretation is that this is a friendly warning. Because it seems a risk was incurred in its execution.
Bravo, Mr. Holmes. You fulfill your reputation, sir. No mistake. But if you're right and this fellow's afraid, then he's afraid not only for his own skin, but what might happen to me?
Quite so. Dr. Mortimer, I think it is time that you explained.
Mortimer unfolds the large parchment. From the other side of the room, a man with a thick dark beard wearing a bowler hat watches them over the top of his copy of the Times.
Well, now you know the facts, Sir Henry. The question is whether or not you should go to Dartmoor.
There's no devil in hell, nor no man on this earth who's going to prevent me from going to the home of my own people.
Then we'll see how we can mitigate the danger.
You really believe there's danger?
I think that if there is, then it is considerable. You certainly cannot go alone.
Dr. Mortimer returns with me.
He has his practice, and he lives many miles distant.
You'll come yourself?
I have to stay in London. Blackmail case. I recommend my friend Watson.
He points sternly at Watson, who blusters in surprise.
That's very kind of you, Doctor.
Holmes raises his eyebrows at Watson. A waiter heaps fruit into a bowl and walks past the group, now on their feet, ready to leave. Holmes shakes hands with Sir Henry and pulls on his top hat. Looking around the room, he notices the bearded man in the bowler hat, who looks up to find Holmes glaring at him. The man gets up.
Watson!
As the man flees, Holmes and Watson give chase.
This way!
They dash down a corridor and through a door leading to a stairwell, the wooden banistered staircase working its way down around the walls. At the the bottom, they race down a narrow corridor and out through the goods entrance into a cobbled courtyard. The bearded man looks out through the glass of a carriage door as he is driven out of the yard. Holmes and Watson can but stand and stare at the departing vehicle. Later, Holmes and Watson sit in a cab.
Who was that man?
I have no idea.
Well, how did you know someone had been following Baskerville?
How else did they know so immediately where he was staying? At least they will not continue to follow him now.
They arrive in Baker Street and get out.
When a crisis comes, Watson, and it will, report to me. Watson, do you know what the residue of Sir Charles Baskerville's estate was?
No, I don't.
Close on a million. A stake for which a man might play a dangerous game.
Leaping up the stairs, Holmes heads for the drawing room.
Such a sum has a definite materiality. And yet, of all things in heaven and earth,
we are men of science, Holmes.
And yet.
Holmes removes his top hat, shuts the door and strides to the window, gazing out thoughtfully.
It's an ugly, dangerous business, Watson. Believe me, I shall be very glad to have you back safe and sound in Baker Street once more.
A serious Watson nods.
Thank you, Holmes.
A two-carriage train rounds a corner, hills of rough grassland and scraggy shrubs and trees rising up on either side of the track. Inside a compartment of the first-class carriage, an inspector hands back Mortimer's ticket and leaves. Next to the window, Sir Henry sits reading a paper. Opposite him, a pensive Watson watches the passing scenery, shrouded in grey locomotive smoke. Pulling his fob watch out of his waistcoat, he finds an envelope stuffed inside the watch pocket. He replaces the watch and examines the front of the envelope. Sir Henry looks across at him and smiles. Watson opens the envelope and starts to read the letter inside.
My dear Watson, I will not bias your mind by suggesting theories or suspicions. Simply report facts to me in the fullest possible manner. Concentrate your attention upon the following.
The train passes a signal box and the signalman pulls a points lever.
Above all, avoid the moor, when, as the old parchment quaintly put it, the powers of evil are exalted.
Watson folds the letter and sighs. The train continues to wind its way along a moorland valley in the bright sunshine. A station master in black uniform and cap closes the front door of his house and walks onto a platform of a small station. The green GWR locomotive approaches the opposite platform. The station master crosses the tracks behind the train, walking up the platform beside the first-class carriage, a porter wheeling a trolley behind him. A train door opens into the clearing steam, and Mortimer, Sir Henry and Watson step out, greeted by the station master. An open carriage, pulled by two horses, is driven up to the front of the station. Mortimer, with his brown and white spaniel on a lead, walks out of the station, the others following. Sir Henry and Watson look puzzled as they pass two policemen waiting by the exit, rifles slung over their shoulders. Later, the three men are in the carriage travelling along a narrow hillside road, bordered by large boulders. A mounted armed policeman watches their progress from the top of a small hillock as they pass by him on the road below. He wears a black uniform with large brass buttons down the front and a black peaked hat.
What is this, Perkins?
Convict, escaped from Princetown, sir. 8 3 days now. Well, they're watching all over. They ain't seen no sign of him. Farmers don't like it.
Who is he?
Selden, the Notting Hill murderer. Folk are locking their doors, I can tell you.
Sir Henry looks questioningly at Watson.
What'd the man do?
He murdered a whole family. With such savagery, they deemed him insane.
Sir Henry turns to look back down the road. The policeman spurs on his bay horse, which walks through the scraggy gorse covering the hillside. Later, they turn off the road and approach a large set of cast-iron gates, which are duly opened. They travel up the tree-lined driveway of the house, swathed in fog, the flaming torches on either side marking their way. Sir Henry looks behind him at the gatehouse and the impressive gates being closed. The house appears in front of them, its dark roofs and chimneys towering up out of the billowing fog. They pull up inside the entrance portico. Solemnly, Mr. and Mrs. Barrymore step out of the front door to greet them, as Sir Henry and Watson clamber out of the back of the carriage.
Welcome, Sir Henry. Welcome to Baskerville Hall.
Thank you. It's Barrymore, yes?
At your service, sir. Mrs. Barrymore?
Madam?
She curtsies. Watson eyes her husband suspiciously as he goes to get their bags from the driver's bench.
If I can be of service, do not hesitate to send for me, day or night.
Of course, thank you.
Walk on!
Barrymore looks gravely at the two men.
This way, Sir Henry.
Sir Henry follows him in, stopping apprehensively in the doorway to glance back at the troubled Watson. The carriage, Mortimer still in the back, clatters its way back down the driveway, underneath the darkening grey sky. Sir Henry walks slowly into the cavernous entrance hall, dimly lit with candles and wall-mounted gas lamps, stone arches on either side. Barrymore looks at him coldly.
500 years of us. Just as I imagined it. Too much as I imagined it. This place needs the products of Messrs. Swan and Edison. But I suppose I can tone down to it.
Barrymore and his wife carry the bags up the large wooden staircase, leaving Watson and Sir Henry below. Sir Henry takes a few steps across the stone floor, gazing up at a dark family portrait of a stern man in his 50s. He pushes his brown felt hat up off his forehead and looks around the walls. A stuffed boar's head hangs next to a stone fireplace, carved with griffins and a heraldic shield. Other family portraits and paintings hang nearby. Sir Henry's eyes come to rest on a painting of Madonna with Child in a large, ornately carved golden frame. He looks down thoughtfully, and then, removing his hat, strolls away, leaving the warmth of the log fire flickering in the hearth. After dinner, the two men sit smoking cigars at a round table in an ornate dining room. More portraits hung on the green-papered walls.
Thank you.
Barrymore serves port.
Excellent meal, Barrymore. Please thank Mrs. Barrymore for us.
Thank you, sir. She'll be pleased you enjoyed it.
Well, Dr. Watson, shall we?
The two dinner-jacketed men rise and walk to the door. Barrymore picks up two small brass ashtrays from the table. In the doorway, Watson turns to look quizzically at Barrymore emptying the ashtrays. Barrymore looks up severely as Watson goes out. Outside, sheets of rain blow across the hillside, sheep grazing unperturbed in the rough stone-walled fields. Back at the hall, Watson comes down the stairs, stopping to look at Sir Henry smoking his cigar by the fire in the entrance hall. He walks down to join him. Barrymore walks stiffly towards the two men. Sir Henry looks at him inquiringly.
Sir, Barrymore, what is it? Sir, my wife and I will be happy to stay with you until you've settled in and made your arrangements.
But your family's been with us for generations. Sorry to start my life here, breaking an old family connection.
Thank you, sir. My wife and I were much attached to Sir Charles and his death. We feel that nothing can be... We feel we shall never be easy here at the Hall, sir.
Sir Henry nods understandingly.
Right. Well, what do you mean to do?
Oh, Sir Charles's generosity has given us the means to set up in business in a small way, sir.
Ah. Well, thank you for telling me. Might I look forward to you pulling me a pint in your own house one day?
That is the sort of thing, sir. Thank you, sir.
Good. Mind you call it Baskerville Arms.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Barrymore turns and walks away. A concerned Sir Henry watches him leave.
That man is frightened.
Sir Henry gently sucks on the end of his cigar, lost in his thoughts. Later, the two men are playing billiards.
Sharp.
Watson retrieves the red ball from a middle pocket, carrying it to the far end of the table.
Turning into a rough night.
I shall walk over to the post office at Grimpen in the morning.
Ah.
I'm sorry, but Holmes... ask me not to let you leave the house without...
Doctor, this shall take care of any dog that I may meet in your absence.
Even armed.
Sir Henry puts his small handgun on the table.
All right. Tomorrow morning she'll find me at home. I'm safe at home, am I?
Well, that's what Holmes believes.
Sir Henry picks up his gun. In the dining room, Mrs. Barrymore lifts up an oval dish containing the remains of a roast chicken. She looks towards her husband, who nods at her, and looking back down at the carcass, she walks out, leaving Barrymore folding up a grey tablecloth and dusting it off with his white-gloved hands. In his room, Watson takes out a black revolver.
It's an ugly and dangerous business, Watson. I shall be glad to have you back, safe and sound, in Baker Street once more.
On hearing the noise, Watson looks up and treads carefully over to the window. Parting the green curtains, he looks out.
It's a realm in which the most accomplished detective is helpless. There are certain things here which are impossible to reconcile to the settled order of nature.
He shuts the curtains and climbs into bed. Reaching across to the bedside table, he picks up Holmes's letter.
Above all, avoid the moor, where, as the old parchment quaintly puts it, the powers of evil are exalted.
He replaces the letter, turns off the bedside lamp, and tensely rests his head on the thick white pillow, his mind still turning with thoughts.
Do you know what the residue of Sir Charles Baskerville's estate was? Close on $1 million. Such a sum has a distinctive materiality about it.
In another part of the house, sobs can be heard. save for the flaming torches along the drive, the house rests in uneasy darkness. A bright sunny morning, Watson is in the post office.
Good morning. How are you today?
All very bad, thank you.
Here we are.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The woman puts his two letters in a rack as Watson walks out.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, sir.
One of the letters is addressed to Holmes. She takes them out of the rack and slips them into the desk in front of her. A man with a butterfly net sits by the road outside.
Dr. Watson? Excuse my presumption. Dr. Mortimer pointed you out to me. From the window of his surgery as you passed. Oh. Possibly he's told you my name. Stapleton, of Merriford House.
Yes, indeed. How do you do?
They walk on.
We were concerned. Franklin, Mortimer and I.
Concerned?
Lest Sir Henry should not come. You know the legend of the fiend hound. We thought it might seize his imagination just as it seized poor Sir Charles's. How is Mr. Sherlock Holmes? Dr. Watson, you are here. It follows then that Mr. Holmes is interested.
I'm afraid I cannot answer your question.
Well, may I ask if he is going to honour us with a visit himself?
He cannot leave town. Other cases engage his attention. I assure you, I'm simply here to visit my friend Sir Henry. I do not need help.
I apologise for the intrusion. A moderate walk along this path brings us to Merriford House. I wonder... Well, perhaps you would spare me an hour, Dr. Watson, that I might have the pleasure of introducing you to my sister.
But I'm expected back at Baskerville Hall. I'm sure an hour will not hurt. Thank you, Mr. Stapleton.
They stroll down the path.
It was entomology, was it, that brought you to the moor?
Indeed. Although I delight in it for its own sake, it is so vast, so barren, so mysterious. Well, there, for instance. What do you make of that?
It'd be a rare place for a gallop.
That is the great Grimpen Mire. False step there means death, to man or beast. Well, only yesterday I saw one of the moor ponies wander into it. He never came out. I could see his head for quite some time, straining out of the bog hole. It sucked him down at last. Even in the dry season, it is a danger to cross it, but after these recent rains, it is an awful place. And yet, I can find my way to the very heart of it and return alive.
Well, why should you wish to visit such a horrible place?
You see the low hills there beyond it? They're really islands. Flora there is undisturbed, which means, of course, that rare species can breed there, and one of them, a subspecies, Lycanidae, is unique to the place. In fact, I'm credited with its discovery.
Really?
The moor is full of noises.
What was it?
The peasants say it is the hound of the Baskervilles calling for its prey.
You don't believe such nonsense, surely.
Did you ever hear the boom of a bittern?
No.
The bird is said, now, to be confined to certain Norfolk fens, but why not here? I've heard its cry described as being something between a foghorn and a soul in torment. What do you think?
He notices something.
Ah. Hi-ali.
Stapleton dashes off, manically waving his net. A bemused Watson watches him leap over the rough terrain. A figure in a long black coat walks into the post office. The woman behind the counter opens her desk and gives him Watson's letters, which he takes with a black-gloved hand. A woman with curly brown hair runs down a path from a large house towards Watson.
Go back! Go straight to London instantly! For God's sake, do what I ask. Go back and never set foot on the moor again. Shh, my brother is coming.
Miss Stapleton.
Get away from this place at all costs. Do you see that orchid?
Yes, I do.
It's a pity you came so late. Our best orchids are nearly over. Jack!
You have introduced yourselves, I see.
Yes. I was telling Sir Henry it's a pity he has missed the beauties of the moor.
Oh, were I Sir Henry, Miss Stapleton, I'm sure I would not miss your beauty, but I'm afraid I am not. Sir Henry, that is. Merely his friend, my Dr. John Watson at your service. Did you catch your butterfly?
No. Harley flies like a witch, I'm afraid.
A black-gloved hand rests on a wall nearby.
Ah, there.
Oh, yes.
He runs off.
You must forgive and forget my foolish outburst, Dr. Watson.
I cannot forget, Miss Stapleton.
You must!
Sir Henry is my friend. His welfare is a very close concern of mine. Tell me why you are so eager that he should return to London.
You know the story of the hound.
I do not believe such nonsense.
But I do. If you have any influence with Sir Henry, take him away.
I fear that unless you can give me more definite information than this, it would be impossible to get him to move.
I cannot say anything definite, for I do not know anything definite.
Miss Stapleton, I would ask you one more question. If you meant no more than this when you first spoke to me, why were you so eager that your brother should not overhear what you said? There is nothing to which he or anybody else could object.
My brother is very anxious to have the hall inhabited. He thinks it's for the good of the poor folk upon the moor. He would be very angry if he knew I had said anything which might induce Sir Henry to go away.
Lifting her long blue skirt with one hand, she runs back to the house.
Any luck?
Afraid not. Flies like a witch. And so beautiful. Pale clouded yellow. I have a number of them, of course. I must show you my collection.
The gloved hand is removed from the wall.
The English Lepidoptera are my field. I have made a particular study of those insects which inhabit the margins of heath and marsh.
Display cases full of butterflies. Later, Watson sits in a study writing.
A magnificent collection and the work of a serious scientist. Even the exotica. I must mention a brilliant creature called Morpho Pelides limpida, was dated and catalogued with the care he applies to his personal field, the British Lycaenidae. One of which is unique to the moor. I must also report that the new brown boot has turned up. Barrymore found it amongst Sir Henry's luggage when he unpacked. Miss Stapleton is very handsome. And on Tuesday, we are to dine here at Baskerville Hall with all our neighbours. So Sir Henry, who chafes a little at the restrictions you have imposed upon him, will have a chance to judge her beauty for himself.
Holmes sits staring into a mirror. Nighttime. Stapleton and his sister Beryl, dressed for dinner, travel in a carriage. They and other guests arrive at the hall.
We are also to meet Dr. Mortimer's wife. And the old vicar of Grimpen, who is very shy, they say. And Mr. Franklin, an amateur astronomer of some note, who has a reputation of being litigious to a fault.
A red letter day. Law is law, and I mean to teach them. I have established a right of way slap through the middle of old Middleton's park. Case decided today. We must teach these magnates they cannot ride roughshod over the rights of commoners. Case decided today.
Today, Mr. Franklin.
Today, sir. Why do you ask?
They are saying in Fernworthy that you've had the wood there closed to the villagers. Also today.
A red letter day, as I said. True, sir. I shall be burnt in effigy tonight in Fernworthy, but I have the case against them. Infernal people seem to think there are no rights of property. They can swarm where they like with their picnic papers and bottles. But why should they complain? No one goes to the wood now. They have to cross the moor to get to it. No one will cross the moor.
And why is that, sir?
You've surely heard. The hound walks abroad upon the moor. The hound of the Baskervilles, Sir Henry.
I've heard. Is it a phenomenon you believe in yourself, Mr. Franklin?
Ask the vicar. Astronomic and forensic matters are my domain. Demonic matters are his.
The red-faced vicar looks up.
Is it a hound of hell, vicar? Or what?
Yes. An interesting question.
whatever it is that has been seen, it is undoubtedly something. Our farrier, Thomas Chubb, is not a man given to visions. And he saw something out there. A dog, he said. But the size of a calf. And I do not think local hysteria is an adequate explanation. Myself. I pray nightly that it remove itself from us, whatever it is. That we all may sleep the more soundly. Yes. Ah.
I believe it is Selden the murderer who frightens the folk. In Grimpen, they believe he is still upon the moor. We are too ready to condescend and attribute superstition to these poor people, when they are in fact subject to a natural and sensible fear.
Bravo, Miss Stapleton. Bravo. This hellhound's existence would not survive a court of law. Mere hearsay. Bring the thing before the bench in the full blaze of jurisprudence, say I, then I will believe in it.
Barrymore opens the front door as the guests begin to leave.
Thank you for a lovely evening.
Very nice to see you.
In another part of the house. At the front door, Sir Henry holds Beryl's hand in a fond goodbye.
Sir Henry.
Yes. Oh, thank you very much.
I've got you, and I'll
keep you to that. Sir Henry!
Yes, my dear.
Wonderful. I must compliment you on that claret. Delicious. Absolutely delicious. Certainly enough.
The vicar climbs into the Stapleton's carriage.
Yes. Oh, my dear chap.
Led by a horseman, the carriage and trap, glowing lanterns on their sides, set off down the driveway. Lit in brilliant moonlight, Watson and Sir Henry stand in the entrance, watching the departing carriages. A maid and Barrymore turn and walk back into the house, the maid curtsying as she passes the host. The carriages having disappeared from view, Sir Henry and Watson amble back inside, shutting the heavy wooden front door. In his room, Watson lies asleep on his back. The door opens and a figure creeps through the gloom towards the bed. Watson wakes startled. A hand is swiftly placed over his mouth. Sir Henry peers down at Watson. He beckons the older man to get up. Both in dressing gowns, they walk quickly and quietly along a corridor and down dimly lit back stairs. They go through a door, both men with their guns at the ready. Sir Henry leads Watson to a small window and looks out. Standing in a window across the lawn, Barrymore holds a lamp.
Barrymore?
Yes. It's been there half an hour.
Barrymore slowly raises and lowers the lamp.
What's he doing?
I don't know.
Look! Out of the moor.
In the blackness, a yellow lantern swings from side to side.
This was adamant, Sir Henry. And you must not go onto the moor in darkness.
Then the powers of evil are exalted, Doctor. Bogies to frighten children, man. Come on. We have the chance of getting to the bottom of this business tonight.
The two men, now fully dressed, walk down the main staircase and go out into the night. On the moor, Watson and Sir Henry push through contorted black tree branches, cloaked in a smothering mass of dense, swirling fog. climbing through a narrow alley between towering boulders, Watson spots something in the moonlight filtering through the fog. They creep towards a glowing lantern. Behind the lantern, a burly man appears and hurls a large rock.
Watch!
Sir Henry ducks behind a boulder, pulling out his handgun, aiming it at the man, who fixes him with a detached, childlike stare. Sir Henry can't bring himself to squeeze the trigger, and the man slowly moves behind the rocks. As the man disappears from view, Sir Henry rushes over to join Watson.
You all right?
Yeah. I thought to shoot, but I couldn't. Come on. Believe there's any truth in these rumors.
Look!
A man in a wide-brimmed hat darts away.
Listen. Harrymore? Well, it's not seldom, at any rate. We were followed in London and we're followed still. Come on. Let's get back to the house.
They approach the gloomy silhouette of the house, enveloped in a shroud of fog. Opening the front door, Sir Henry stops, seeing Barrymore and his wife by the fire in the entrance hall.
What's this all about, Barrymore?
Sir, it may seem that we have betrayed your trust.
See! Damn it, Barrymore, you have!
Sir, it's no fault of his, sir. He didn't want it, it's me. It's me and mine. The poor creature came to me for help, sir. How could I refuse after what they have done to him?
Selden, Mrs. Barrymore, I don't understand. Why should he come to a respectable woman?
Distressed, she looks away.
He's her brother, sir.
What?
It's true, sir. He dragged himself here, half starved. And what would you expect? We fed him. We took food out for him, sir, no more than he would for a dog. We hoped he'd go, but the light has been there, night after night.
Is this true, Barrymore?
Yes, sir.
Have you any conception what this man did, Barrymore?
Yes, sir. But he's a broken man. They done surgery, sir, to tame him. He's like a child, sir.
Mrs. Barrymore runs at Sir Henry, sinking at his feet.
Mrs. Barrymore, please get up. This is not dignified.
By your leave, sir, arrangements have been made. You'll be out of the country in a few days. I beg you, sir, say nothing to the police.
Sir Henry looks down thoughtfully and then turns to Watson.
What do you think, Doctor?
You say he's harmless now, Barrymore. Yet he threw a rock at us.
As a child might throw stones, sir. The murderer's heart has gone out of him. He's but a frightening baby now, sir.
This is an apt description. He will be harmless.
Very well. Please take your wife to your room. We'll say nothing about this matter.
Mrs. Barrymore buries her head in her husband's shoulder.
Thank you, sir.
Supporting his anguished wife, Barrymore leads her away and through a glass-paned wooden door into their quarters.
I thought we had a chance of getting to the bottom of this business. All we seem to have done is compound a felony.
Watson nods. Sir Henry paces over to the stone fireplace around, leaning on it and resting his teeth thoughtfully on his black-gloved thumb.
I'm glad, though, that you heard that sound on the moor. I was beginning to think I'd dreamt it.
I was in the territories once. I heard wolves up there. Nothing to freeze the blood like that sound tonight.
Are you convinced it's a hound?
I am. I would to God Holmes was here. Why does he not come?
A grey morning over the vast moor.
And yet, Holmes, when daylight and birdsong return, the black imaginings of the night evaporate. Even Dr. Mortimer's assiduous visits, accompanied as they are by constant talk of bones, our mortal residue, fail to sour the beauties of the moor in autumn.
An ancient bridge of roughly hewn stones, a glinting stream beneath. Baskerville Hall.
We are, however, still far from the heart of the mystery. The question which most persistently nags at me is, who is the man on the tor? With his identity known, I feel we should have the key to this fatal riddle within our grasp.
This is a rather nice piece of cloth. I picked this up in Baltimore, but I never wear it.
Meanwhile, I have discovered a streak of amiable tender-heartedness in my host.
Oh, this.
So guilty did he feel at nearly shooting his servant's murderous brother-in-law that he has given Barrymore many of his excellent American clothes. Determined, as he now is, to play the role of English squire, in dress, as in anything else.
Much too American. I'm turning over a new leaf. You take it.
Thank you kindly, sir.
Barrymore folds up a brown checked suit on top of a pile of others laid out on a bed. Sitting at the desk in the downstairs study, Watson slides the folded letter into an envelope and licks the seal. He turns round as Sir Henry wanders into the room.
Very smart, Sir Henry.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to stroll over to Merripit House. I thought I'd invite Stapleton and his sister, rather I should say, Miss Stapleton and her brother to luncheon on Monday.
Well, I know you won't want me to come with you there, but Holmes insisted that...
Now look here, my friend. Holmes could not have foreseen certain developments. You'd make a very civil gooseberry, but no, I'm afraid I have to go alone.
Sir Henry, dressed in a grey tweed suit, smiles at Watson, turns and leaves the room. Concerned, Watson turns to gaze out of the window. A train puffs its way through the countryside.
London, next stop.
In a first-class compartment, Holmes opens his eyes. Sir Henry, wearing a flat cap and swinging a walking stick, strides across a field and climbs over a stone wall. He carries on through the brown stalks of dead bracken towards a rocky outcrop. Watson follows surreptitiously behind, stopping at the wall, watching Sir Henry disappear from view behind the rocks. Watson starts to follow once more. Sir Henry walks down into a wide grassy gully, bordered on all sides by towering piles of weather-worn rock. Beryl, in a long dark grey dress, waits, smiling, at the bottom of the gully. She starts to walk slowly up the gully. Sir Henry runs down to greet her, arms outstretched. Above them, Watson sits on a rock, planting his stick into the soft earth. Sir Henry takes Beryl's arms in his gloved hands, talking excitedly to her. He leans forward, and they kiss. Watson watches awkwardly.
Baskerville! Baskerville! How dare you, sir! Make advances to my sister in such a fashion.
Jack!
I'm sure the lady gave you no reason to presume upon her good intentions. We welcome you into our circle, sir. And you repay the hospitality by forcing your disgusting attentions upon her.
No, but I assure you, sir, my intentions are honorable.
Away to the hall! Beryl!
Grabbing her elbow, Stapleton marches Beryl away. Watson lowers his binoculars and then watches Sir Henry walk dejectedly back up the gully, turning to glance back at the spot where Stapleton confronted him, and then carrying on, swiping his stick at the ground. Watson stands and waits for Sir Henry to climb up to him. Sir Henry looks up and sees Watson. He stops, taken aback, before walking towards his friend.
Hello, Watson. Where have you dropped from?
I took it upon myself to follow you. I'm afraid my duty to Holmes overrode my tact.
I see. Well, I hope they're not selling tickets in Grimpen. I assume you saw what happened?
Mm-hmm.
Agitated, Sir Henry sits on a boulder, resting his forehead on a hand.
Did he ever strike you as a bit crazy, this brother of hers?
Not particularly.
Oh, well, he does me. What's he getting so heated about? What objection can he have to me as a brother-in-law? I mean, he can't object to my worldly position, so... it's gotta be me myself. Oh, I don't know. Do you see it?
Not at all.
Nor me. Oh, thanks.
He takes a cigarette.
He won't let us be together, not for a moment. You must realize... oh, I don't understand. There's a light in her eyes... it speaks louder than words. I know it. I know it in my heart. But he treats me as if I was a mad seducer in an old melodrama. Oh, it's absurd.
Perhaps.
What?
I was just thinking that this business with the hound and the family curse and so on, if Stapleton partly believes it's true, perhaps he might want his sister not to be...
yes, I know.
Just till the business is resolved.
Sir Henry stands, staring pensively down at Watson.
Yes, of course. Well, shall we walk home together?
He strides away. Watson puffs on his cigarette and sighs before gathering his things and following. London. At the station, Holmes gets into a hansom cab.
The Royal Observatory, please.
The two-wheeled cab drives off and later pulls into a courtyard outside a large stone building. At the hall, a maid collects a walking stick and soft cap and gloves.
Forever in your debt.
Oh, no, not at all. Well, good day.
Good day, Sir Henry.
Stapleton takes his things from the maid and walks out. Bemused, Sir Henry follows him to the doorway and leans on the thick wooden frame, watching Stapleton leave. Watson comes into the entrance hall, passing the maid, who curtsies as he nods to her.
Well, well.
What happened?
Stapleton. I still think the fellow's crazy, but he's just given me the most complete apology a man's ever likely received in his life, and he's invited us to dinner tomorrow. Friday, indeed.
Good. I look forward to it.
Watson buttons his coat.
Ah, the post at Grimpen.
Just so.
Watson waves two envelopes and goes out. Sir Henry goes back into the billiards room. In the post office, Watson hands over his letters.
Thank you, sir.
The old postmistress places the letters into the rack and watches him go outside. She takes the letters out of the rack and secretes them in her desk. In Baker Street, Holmes stares out of the drawing room window at the carriages and people passing below. Nighttime on platform 2. A tall man in a long grey coat walks past wooden train carriages, disappearing into thick smog. Morning on the moor. White mist settled in the valleys of the undulating countryside. In the study, Watson is sitting at a desk writing. Sir Henry reclines on a sofa. The two men look towards the door as Barrymore comes in.
May I have a word, sir?
Of course.
Barrymore steps towards them.
You've been very good to us, sir, and I should like to do the best I can for you. There's something I found out, sir.
Yes?
We found it after the inquest and told a mortal soul, didn't know how. About Sir Charles's death, sir.
Both men get to their feet.
You know how he died?
No, sir.
Well, what then?
I do know why he was at the gate at that hour.
Why?
To meet a woman, sir.
A woman? Are you sure?
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, what was her name?
I can only give you her initials, sir. Yes, it was something my wife found. She was cleaning out this very room, Sir Charles's study, sir. And in the grate there, she found this scrap of paper. Oh, 'twas all burnt, but... well, it could still be read. From the shine in the writing, if you know what I mean, sir.
Of course, I understand. Please go on.
Well, she called to me, and I wrote it down. Please. Please, as you are a gentleman, burn this letter and be at the gate by 10 o'clock. Then the initials. L.L.
He hands the scrap of paper to Sir Henry, who examines it carefully. Both men look up at Barrymore's serious, unmoving features. In his room, dressed in his thick brown coat, Watson folds up a map. Opening the desk drawer, he takes out a packet of bullets and his revolver, putting them both into an inside pocket of his greatcoat and walking out of the room, binoculars slung over his shoulder. Aweir on a fast-flowing river, its glassy waters foaming in a white swirling mass before flowing underneath an arched stone bridge. Watson stops on the bridge and, map in hand, looks up at a large turreted country house on top of a steep grassy bank. He looks back down at the map, in the centre of which is a hill on which is written Laughter Hall. He walks up the wet grass of the bank.
Good afternoon, Dr. Watson!
Franklin waves from the roof.
Mr. Franklin!
Come along up! I shall order you tea.
Thank you.
You're here to solve the Baskerville mystery, are you not? Well, I have a telescope. I see things on the moor. Surely you should know about them.
With a puzzled smile, Watson salutes a wave and walks up to the house. Inside, they climb narrow stairs. A portrait of a young red-haired girl hangs in the stairwell.
A striking portrait. Laura. Your daughter, Mr. Frank.
Yes. Yes, that is my daughter. The woman she has become is not. This way, Doctor.
How's that? Disinherited her. Oh,
I'm sorry to hear it.
You are. What do you suppose such a thing does to a father, huh? This way. Married her seducer, sir. An artist. So-called. Not that artist. That artist earned his living. Her artist was too grand to earn his living. Artist? Wastrel. Lyons. Fellow called Lyons. Ever heard of him?
No, actually. Laura Lyons.
Nobody has. After her money. My money. I was burnt in effigy in Fernworthy last week.
You predicted that, I remember.
Exactly so, because I know the slackness of authority hereabouts. The case of Franklin v. Regina will bring the matter before the attention of the public.
I told the police they would have occasion to regret their treatment of me, and already my words have come true.
How so?
I could tell them what they are dying to know.
But you're not going to.
Certainly not.
So, a case of poaching.
Poaching fiddlesticks! The convict, sir. Selden, the mad stabber.
You don't mean to say you know where he is.
Near enough.
It has never occurred to the police that the way to catch the man was to find out where he got his food, and so trace it to him.
Barrymore.
His food is taken to him by a child.
A child?
Why not? I have observed the child for more than a week.
He looks through a telescope.
It is in the nature of children to form perverse allegiances.
A
Surely it's more likely to be the child of a moorland shepherd taking him his lunch.
Flocks, move. Quick! Dr. Watson, quick.
Watson puts an eye to the lens.
Yes, I see him.
A boy of about 8 carrying a red and white bundle disappears behind a brown blanket hung at the entrance to a cave. Now, in bright sunshine, Watson strolls through the countryside, coming to the top of a small incline and looking down on a white canvas canopy neatly erected on a rocky slope. Underneath, Mortimer is arranging bone specimens on tables.
Dr. Mortimer!
Dr. Watson! I have something marvellous to show you!
As Watson approaches, Mortimer picks up a freshly cleaned human skull.
Isn't it beautiful?
Splendid.
The most complete of its kind I've yet found. I found it myself, what's more. The labourers aren't here today. It is quite, quite beautiful.
Noticing something in the distance, he picks up a shotgun. Watson moves out of the way.
If there's one animal on this planet which I cannot abide, it is a rabbit.
Really?
Rabbit's burrow? Have you any conception of what a family of rabbits can do to the chronology of a dick in a single night?
Mortimer collects his thoughts.
You are on your way to the necropolis. I could show you round if you like.
The necropolis?
Most people think it a Neolithic village, but I have reason to believe it a burial ground. Some most interesting features.
I should be glad of your company. There's someone bivouacked near there.
Who is it?
It's the man who's been at Sir Henry's heels since he landed here. I can't think his motives are benevolent. So, if you come, I shall be obliged if you bring that gun you handle so well. There may be some danger.
If there's to be danger, then two guns will be better than one.
Yes.
The two men set out.
Do you know Laura Lyons?
Old Franklin's daughter. Yes, she's a patient of mine. She lives in Coombe Tracy. He's cut her off, you know, without a penny.
Do you know if she was acquainted with Sir Charles?
It's possible. After her marriage went wrong, she was able to set up for herself in a small way. As a typist, Sir Charles may have made that possible. He was a man who fostered many good causes. She may have been one of them.
What sort of a painter was Lyons?
Oh, brilliant.
They continue on, Mortimer's spaniel at their heels, the afternoon sun illuminating the rough grass, gorse and rocky outcrops of the bleak landscape. Now, in a more wooded area, they reach the bottom of a steep slope and climb up over the boulders to a sheep track running between the rocks. Watson stops. With his revolver, Watson indicates the entrance to the cave. Mortimer snaps his shotgun shut and they climb the narrow path to the cave. Watson draws back the blanket at the entrance, peering inside. Crouching down, Mortimer creeps in. Outside, Watson looks carefully around before taking a couple of last puffs on his cigarette, throwing down the butt and going inside. A figure in a long black coat, black trousers, and smart black shoes walks across the rocks. Watson lights an oil lamp and looks around at the bare walls of the cave. Mortimer, investigating a small collection of belongings, picks up a scrap of paper, which he reads with interest before handing it to Watson.
Dr. Watson is a laughter whore.
Perhaps it is you who's been dogged by this secret man, and not Sir Henry at all. What do we do?
I intend to wait.
Both men pick up their weapons. Watson sits down on a wooden chair next to the red and white checked bundle. Mortimer remains standing, stroking his dog. The sun is starting to set. A black-gloved hand reaches into a patch of grass, removing a cigarette butt. Holmes, wearing a wide-brimmed hat, looks carefully at the butt in his hand and smiles. Watson and Mortimer suddenly start. Lamp. Mortimer turns the lamp down.
It's a lovely evening, Doctor. I really think you would be more comfortable outside than in.
They rush out.
When I see a cigarette stub marked Bradley, Oxford Street, I know my friend Watson is in the neighborhood. Be careful with that gun.
I thought you were in Baker Street, working out that case of blackmail.
That is what I wished you to think.
Holmes thrusts out his hand. Watson rushes over, shaking it warmly.
I deserve better at your hands, Holmes. You use me and do not trust me.
Well, my presence would have warned our very formidable opponents and put them on their guard. It was essential that you and Sir Henry believe me to be London all the time and behaved accordingly. Dr. Mortimer.
Mr. Holmes.
How long have you been in Devon?
I fancy you saw me on my second night when I was foolish enough to show myself against the moon.
And all my reports have been wasted.
No. Here they are. And very well thumbed, I assure you. I had to subvert the local post office. Brilliant, my dear fellow. Brilliant.
You must, I know, have much to discuss, and I must be getting home. Please, one question, Mr. Holmes. Are you any closer to discovering what, if anything, the hound is?
Holmes stares ahead, steely-eyed.
I am.
Does it exist?
It does. Thank you, Dr. Mortimer.
Mr. Holmes? Good day, Dr. Watson.
Thank you for your help.
Now let me see what meager refreshment I can provide.
Watson and Holmes clamber into the cave. Watson turns the oil lamp back up.
Cartwright, the little chap from the express office. I brought him down with me to look after my simple wants. A loaf of bread and a clean collar.
I've discovered that there's a woman living in Coombe Tracey with the initials LL.
Ah, yes, Franklin's daughter. Laura Lyons. Our researchers have been running along the same lines.
Holmes pours stew from a black pan.
Did you know that she's seeking a divorce from her husband? But she lacks the means to carry it through. It is a costly business. Do try, my stew.
Ah. Now, Dr. Mortimer thought that Sir Charles might have been a discreet benefactor.
Really? That's interesting. Please, Watson.
Watson looks down in revulsion at the brown lumpy mush in front of him.
It's quite disgusting, Holmes.
Yes. Yes, it is. Well, it's better when it's hot. Did you know there was a close intimacy between Laura Lyons and the entomologist, Stapleton?
No, I did not.
Yes, they meet. They write. She's no doubt counting on becoming his wife. That is the most powerful weapon in our hands.
How? I don't understand.
Because Miss Stapleton is in reality Stapleton's wife, not his sister.
His wife?
Yes, it was she who sent us that warning to the Northumberland Hotel.
Why this elaborate deception?
Don't ask me for particulars, Watson, but it is murder. Refined, cold-blooded, deliberate murder.
What led you to?
He is a genuine entomologist. But that mention of his sole claim to fame, his discovery of a subspecies, Lycaenidae, that was his fatal moment. There can only be one discoverer of a species. That pinpointed him. It has been a hard trail.
They rush outside. It's now dark. A ghostly, luminescent hound bounds across rocks, pouncing on a man. The man falls from a cliff. Watson and Holmes approach the cliff edge and look down.
It's Sir Henry!
The man lies on his back, arm over his face. Watson and Holmes climb down through dark, rocky masses, swirling with fog. A figure crouching behind bushes watches their progress. Now beside the body, Holmes slowly removes the man's arm from his face.
It's Selden.
Sir Henry's clothes were the poor devil's death.
Poor devil indeed. It was only a half life in truth.
No one must know for the moment. We must hide the body.
The man crouching behind the bushes slopes off. Later, an empty trap is driven away from Baskerville Hall. Watson and Holmes walk through the front door.
Sir Henry must know nothing of hearing the hound. He'll have a better nerve for the ordeal he must undergo tomorrow. So, this is Baskerville Hall.
Holmes picks up a candelabra and walks into the entrance hall, Watson following behind.
One moment, Watson.
Holmes stops at the foot of the staircase, and then, holding up the candelabra, he looks around at the walls. The ornate fireplace, the large family portraits in their gilt frames, the picture of Madonna and Child. He takes a couple of steps up the staircase, noticing the dark portrait of the stern man. Another portrait catches his attention. His jaw falls. Narrowing his eyes, he walks towards it. It's of a man in his 40s, wearing an 18th-century flowing white wig. He rushes over to it, climbs on a chair, and puts his arm across the top of the head.
Who?
It's Stapleton. He's a Baskerville.
Sir Charles's brother, who died of yellow fever in Costa Rica, did not die childless. We have him, Watson. We have him. And I dare swear that by tomorrow night, he will be fluttering in our net as helpless as one of his own butterflies.
The next morning, Watson, Holmes and Sir Henry sit around the breakfast table as Barrymore walks in.
I fear that Watson and I must go to London.
London?
I think we will be more useful there at this present juncture.
Holmes, puffing calmly on a cigarette, observes Barrymore suspiciously.
Excuse me. Might I have some fresh coffee?
Certainly, sir.
But I thought you were going to see me through this business.
Holmes places two fingers over his lips. Sir Henry looks round at Barrymore as he goes to fetch the coffee.
Trust me, my dear fellow.
I do.
Tell Stapleton that I would have been happy to come with you, but that urgent business required me to be in town.
I don't understand. Should I not come with you to London? Why should I stay here alone?
No, you must stay. And do exactly as I tell you.
Of course I will.
Drive to Merripit House. Send the trap back. And let it be known that you intend to walk home.
Across the moor. At night.
If I had not every confidence in your nerve and courage, I would not suggest it. It is essential that you do this.
Then I will do just what you say.
Take the path. Exactly on the path from Merripit House to the Grimpen Road. It is your natural way home.
Barrymore comes back in.
And when do you intend to leave?
He carries two coffee pots to the table.
Immediately after breakfast.
Thank you, Barrymore.
Sir.
Barrymore goes out once more. Holmes and Watson arrive at the small station by trap. Climbing out of the trap, both in long, thick coats and hats, Watson pays the driver, and the two men walk onto the platform, getting into the first-class carriage of the waiting train. The trap leaves the station. A carriage door opens onto the tracks, and Holmes and Watson climb down onto the pebbled railway line, walking along, heads bowed, as the train pulls out. They cross the tracks and walk up the ramp onto the opposite platform. Holmes bashes the silver handle of his stick against a rough wooden front door. A red-haired woman opens the door.
Mrs. Lyons?
Yes?
In her drawing room.
So, you admit that you asked Sir Charles to meet you at the gate at 10 o'clock, but you say that you did not keep the appointment.
I did not.
You do realise that was the very hour of his death.
She swings round.
Is that an accusation, sir?
No. I'm only asking if you can forge a connection between the two events.
There is no connection.
Mrs. Lyons, we believe this to be a case of murder. And the evidence may implicate not only your friend, Mr. Stapleton, but his wife as well.
His wife?
Mrs. Lyons, the person who has passed for his sister is really his wife.
She slumps down onto a chair.
His wife?
Now Laura splashes her face with water from a porcelain bowl in a bathroom. She stands and looks miserably at herself in an oval mirror before wiping her face with a small white towel. Sighing and blinking back tears, she leaves the bathroom. She walks down a hallway, stopping at a door and leaning against the frame, collecting herself before opening the door into the drawing room. Watson stands and joins Holmes by a table, watching her. Not betraying any emotion, she paces slowly towards them. Holmes offers a hand and helps her onto a chair. The two men sit and face her.
Mr. Holmes. Mr. Stapleton offered me marriage on condition I could obtain a divorce from my husband. He told me he... Oh, he has lied. He has lied and lied and lied. Why should I preserve faith with him who never kept any with me? Ask me what you will. There is nothing I shall hold back.
You have said Sir Charles helped you to set yourself up as a professional typist. Presumably that was after your husband deserted you.
Yes. Sir Charles knew my father would not help me. One thing I swear to you. When I wrote the letter, I never dreamed of any harm to the old gentleman who had been my kindest friend.
I entirely believe you, madam. And Sir Charles used Stapleton as an intermediary?
He did not like to be seen to be doing good.
And the letter that you sent to Sir Charles on the day of his death?
I needed money for my divorce. I had heard he was leaving for London.
And the sending of the letter was suggested by Stapleton?
He dictated it. The reason he gave was that Sir Charles would help with the legal expenses of my divorce.
And he dissuaded you from keeping the appointment?
She nods.
And swore me to silence concerning it. He said that the death had been a very mysterious one, and that I should certainly be suspected were the facts to become known. He frightened me into silence.
You were very fortunate escape, Mrs. Lyons. You have been near the edge of the precipice.
She looks down. Now, Watson and Holmes walk across a lawn to the black front door of Mortimer's grey stone house.
Students of criminology will remember the incidents in Grodno in Little Russia in the year 66. And of course they are the Anderson murders in North Carolina. But this case possesses features which are entirely its own.
Inside.
Dr. Watson tells me that you handle a gun.
I am fairly proficient.
Well, it was you who first brought this case to our attention. It is only right that you'd be with us at the climax.
Mortimer looks up in surprise.
Thank you.
Late evening, the fog settling into the valleys, the bare branches of the trees black against the fading light. A trap carries Watson, Holmes and Mortimer up a rough hillside track.
While Dr. Mortimer and I guard the path, you watch the house, Watson.
Near the top of the hill, the trap comes to a halt, and the three men climb out of the small door at the back. The trap leaves. The three men stand looking around the darkening countryside.
I don't like it. There's fog in the air. It's in the hollows already.
Holmes strides off. Mortimer snaps shut his shotgun.
Be careful, Watson.
Mortimer follows Holmes, leaving Watson examining his revolver. Green, glowing paws pad through the undergrowth.
I'm so pleased you could come. It's a pity Dr. Watson had to return to London. Nevertheless, I'm sure we'll have a pleasant evening together.
Outside the house, Watson watches Stapleton and Sir Henry sit down to dinner. Later, Watson snaps shut the barrel of his revolver. Crouched behind a wall, he stares across the lawn, seeing Stapleton rise from the table.
If you'd excuse me for a moment, Sir Henry. I shan't be long.
Finishing a glass of port, Stapleton leaves Sir Henry alone at the table. In an attic room, Beryl, bloody and dirty, sits bound and gagged.
Help! Help! Please! Help me!
Downstairs, Sir Henry sits at the table smoking a cigar and sipping a cup of coffee. Outside, Watson looks around as he hears a noise. Watson gets to his feet and, gun in hand, creeps away to join Holmes and Mortimer out on the fog-veiled moor.
Sir Henry was still inside the house when I left.
It's getting late. You say Beryl Stapleton was not there?
No. I cannot think where she might be. And there were only two places laid for dinner.
The fog is getting thicker all the time. Courage, Sir Henry. Brave it.
The eerie glowing form of an enormous hound. Sir Henry walks slowly along a fog-carpeted path, dark rocks bearing down. He stops, looking anxiously around. Holmes, Watson and Mortimer creep through murky vegetation, guns raised. Sir Henry walks on. Holmes swings round in the direction of the panting. The three men steal along a path. The ugly beast bounds towards them. Sir Henry stops. A huge canine head looms forth. Holmes stands over the creature as its limp, iridescent hulk slides off Sir Henry. Holmes kneels down, pulling Sir Henry up and holding him to his chest.
You're a brave man. Doctor!
It's all right, Sir. It's all right.
Mortimer kneels beside the hound.
The hound got past us. Now, if you can manage it, we must get back to the house as soon as possible.
Stroking the beast's hair, Mortimer's fingers stain with luminous powder.
Phosphorus.
Holmes angrily raps his stick on the glass-paned door of Stapleton's house. An elderly manservant opens it.
No! Sir, no! Sir! I protest, sir! It's happening! Sir, you are not allowed!
What's...
Watson joins Holmes as he dashes up the stairs.
Stop, sir, stop!
Holding a silver candelabra, Holmes opens the doors of upstairs rooms. Out on the moor, Stapleton runs through a swirling mass of fog, reaching the ghostly corpse. He stops, looking down at the dead animal, before striding away, incongruous in his dinner suit. In the dingy attic room, Beryl struggles with her bindings.
The door's locked.
Help! Help me! Help! Hey, help! In here! Help!
Bursting into the room, Holmes places the candelabra on the floor. He and Watson kneel beside her, undoing the tight cloth gag and wrist ligatures.
She's badly hurt.
She leans her blood-stained cheek against Holmes's chest. He rests his chin in her thick mass of curly brown hair. On the moor, Stapleton struggles on through the dense white fog. He stops to take in his bearings, before hurrying on, and then stopping once more. Holmes supports Beryl as they slowly descend the main staircase. She stumbles and sits on a stair.
I thought this man loved me. He loves nothing. Where is he? The police have...
He escaped.
She turns her bruised face away from Holmes.
He will go to his island in the mire.
The manservant goes to the door. Mortimer and Sir Henry step inside. Beryl rises to her feet as she meets Sir Henry's gaze. She smiles as they stare tenderly at one another, their eyes glowing brightly from their weary, bloodied faces. Stapleton walks purposefully through long marsh grasses. His foot sinks into the muddy bog.
No.
Taking a further unbalanced step, he slides down into a boggy pit, waist deep in cloying mud.
Help me! Please! Somebody help me!
His screams echo around the grounds of Baskerville Hall. Sinking quickly, the muddy water covers his shoulders, lapping against his gaping mouth. Gasping for air, the sucking waters pull him down. His petrified face disappears into the squelching brown liquid.
Holmes had established that Stapleton had bought the dog from Mangles of the
Fulham... Ross! And Mangles in the Fulham Road in London.
Ross and Mangles of the Fulham Road, London.
In Baker Street, Watson is writing a report.
He took it on the North Devon line and walked a great distance over the moor to his home. As we know, he eventually kennelled it at the heart of the Grimpen Mire.
The Grimpen Mire.
How on earth did he expect to claim the inheritance if this creature had mauled Sir Henry to death?
Mauled? Very good word, Watson. Through intermediaries, Beryl Stapleton said that he intended to return to Central America and conduct his claim upon the estate from the depths of Costa Rica.
Having established his identity as a Baskerville through the British authorities there.
Of course, he had no interest in the estate. He simply wanted the money.
What about the boot? He stole the boot, presumably, to have an article of Sir Henry's clothes, to set the hound on him.
That is why the new boot would not do. Sir Henry had not worn it. Watson, we are late.
Holmes drives a small carriage, Watson sitting beside him.
I have tickets for a Huguenot at Covent Garden. A little dinner at Mancini's on the way.
Wonderful, Holmes.
Piper! Piper! Who wants an evening Piper?
The busy street scene freezes in sepia tint. The audio description was written and read by Mark Leavesley and made available with the kind support of ITFC. Sherlock Holmes was played by Jeremy Brett, Dr. John Watson by Edward Hardwick, Sir Charles Baskerville, Raymond Adamson, Dr. Mortimer, Neil Duncan. Barrymore, Ronald Pickup. Mrs. Barrymore, Rosemary McHale. Sir Henry Baskerville, Christopher Tabori. Purser, Edward Romford. Stapleton, James Faulkner. Pageboy, Philip Detmer. Perkins, Stephen Tomlin. Beryl Stapleton, Fiona Gillies. Frankland, Bernard Horsfall. Vicar of Grimpen, Donald MacKillop. Sheldon, William Ilkley. Postmistress, Myrtle Devenish. Laura Lyons, Elizabeth Spender. Manservant, Donald Bissett. Stuntman, Gareth Milne. Production Manager, Roy Jackson. Production Assistant, Helen R. Emerson. Unit Manager, David Weir. Camera Operator, Andy Stephen. Focus Puller, Ian Beasley. Charge Hand Electrician, Frank Pryor. Sound Recordist, Phil Taylor. Boom Operator, Harry Brooks. Dubbing Mixer, Tony Anscombe. Sound Editor, Peter Deakin. Makeup, Ruth Quinn. Costume, Kate Turner. Graphic Designer, Ray Freeman. Optical Effects, Lyndon Evans. Research, Leslie Beams. Production Buyer, David Round. Charge Hand ASM, Bill Roberts. Casting Director, Joan McCann. Music composed by Patrick Gowers. Film Editor, Alan Ringland. Lighting Cameraman, Michael B. Popley. Production Designers, Christopher J. Bradshaw and James Weatherup. Executive Producer, Michael Cox. Producer, June Wyndham Davis. Director, Brian Mills. Granada Television, 1988.